Hey, my friend, welcome to the Tradie Success Podcast. This episode is brought to you by the Tradie Success Academy. We're on a mission to help trade and construction business owners unlock time and financial freedom within as little as 3 years. With the right processes and systems and support, we're able to help people level up with less mistakes and have the motivation and support and guidance around systemization and process, whether that comes to lead generation, conversions, on-site value delivery, maximizing efficiency and profitability, operations and administration, or personal performance, how to really maximize yourself as a business owner and unlock that growth in your own business. Now, whether you're a sole trader or you've been in business for years and years, we're here to support you no matter what size you are. So look in the show notes. We've got a link to an exclusive offer for the podcast where you get 30 days free of the Academy Mastermind program. On there, you'll get access to online, on-demand training videos, access to live training every single week, and access to an amazing trade community filled with all different types of trades supporting one another to unlock that growth potential. Click the link in the show notes and unlock your free trial now. Hi everyone, welcome to the Tradie Success Podcast. I'm here with Russ Stevens from the Association of Professional Builders. Really lovely to have you on the show, Russ.
Hey, thanks so much, Greg. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to finding out about what you've been working on. I've just gone through the annual report from last year and some really exciting stuff to be talking around. Before we do, I'd love to find out a little bit about yourself and how you got into the role that you're doing now at the Association of Professional Builders.
Sure. Well, I guess the story kind of started around about 2011, around about 2011 when I came across some project management software in the US called CoConstruct. I then introduced that to Australia, New Zealand and the UK. And over the next few years, signed up over 1,000 builders into that software. And one of the things I did realize from doing that was, we solved one problem there with their project management, but they were all saying they needed more leads and more sales. So yeah. With that, I launched with my daughter a marketing agency dedicated to the residential construction industry. And we built websites, managed Facebook and Google campaigns and did lead generation for builders. But what we did notice is some of the builders were saying, this is great, problem solved. And the other half were saying the leads were rubbish, which was weird. So when we delved into it, we realized that the guys that were struggling didn't have a documented sales process. So that was the next step. We introduced sales training, documented out the sales process for builders. And once again, some of the guys were sorted with generating quality leads and helping them to turn them into contracts. But there were still guys that were struggling to make money and they were time poor, which is why in 2015, we launched the Association of Professional Builders, full business coaching covering financials, time management, marketing, sales and operations.
Amazing. What a journey. Cool. So could you tell us about the job management system? Because I wasn't aware that you got into that space. So what is the job management system and like how did you come around like actually building that out?
Well, funny enough, I was trying to develop a solution for residential home builders at the time myself using a combination of Microsoft Dynamics and a couple of other bits of software and trying to piece it together that gave builders a process that mainly managed their communication because that's where it all goes wrong between the builder and the client. It's the communication not being documented. So I was trying to solve that problem. And then I happened to be talking to a builder in Sydney over the phone and he said you really should check out this CoConstruct. It's pretty much doing what you're trying to achieve here. So I jumped on a webinar at 3 a.m. because there were live webinars back in those days. You didn't have the recorded options. And we're creeping down the stairs at 3 a.m. to watch this webinar and it kind of blew my mind. And it was good and it was bad. It was good because he was this great solution for builders, but it was also sad that it kind of negated everything I was trying to achieve. So I abandoned my own project, contacted Donnie White at CoConstruct and set up a deal to represent CoConstruct in Australia, New Zealand and the UK.
Amazing. Cool. That's so good. So you're saying like the biggest challenge that people have is the communication breakdown between client and builder. So
What is some of the examples of where this goes terribly wrong? So where you might find that the client is completely upset with the end result or the communication breakdown, what is the result there?
Well, a lack of documentation is always a big thing because clients do tend to forget what was said, especially when you go back 6-9 months. But it kind of gets even worse once construction's underway and you introduce a third party, being the subcontractors, because you know some clients tend to go on site and then they start instructing people on site what to do, and any change to the contract leaves the builder terribly exposed. And also, if it's not documented and agreed, then there's a variation coming, maybe from the subcontractor to the builder, that the builder can't claim from the actual client. So that's probably one of the biggest pain points once the contract has started. It's this triangle of communication that starts. So it's very important that the builder is very, very clear with both the client and also the subcontractor that there can be no changes unless it's been agreed and communicated through them.
Yeah, is there anything, because I understand, because I've got an electrical contracting business as well, and that's one of the biggest things is when you turn up to do some electrical work, but then it's substandard or there's something that wasn't, you know, obvious during quotation or estimation phase, and you, now that we've got into doing the work, it's uncovered something that was not standard. How do we best, as a subcontractor, communicate that to the builder and then be able to get the variation through with the client, do you feel?
Well, first of all, I think if there's any variation to the contract, the scope of works, it's got to come in writing from the builder themselves, and especially where there's going to be extra cost involved, you know, for you as a subcontractor, and you're going to need to be reimbursed, you're going to need to present a quote for that work. The builder then has to quote the client and get that approved in writing before that work can proceed. I think that's really, really important, and that just comes down from communication and really clear communication from the builder to you guys as well, clearly defining their position and the consequences really of bypassing that.
I think also getting really clear on who speaks to who, because sometimes you get the subcontractor employee like come out and they just like start talking to the client and creating this huge problem in the client's mind, and the builder's like, what the hell is going on? So getting clear in writing and making sure every staff member is trained to be able to speak to the builder, not to the client, so that, you know, they can follow the proper process effectively.
Yeah, you nailed it. It's training, isn't it? It's on site you can be in a difficult position. You know, you got someone in front of you that they think they're the boss, to be honest, don't they? The clients. Yeah. We always say, you're buying the end result, not the process.
And that happens internal in within organizations as well, where like someone bypasses the manager to the big business owner or something like that. So you see people
never ends well, does it?
Yeah. All right, cool, great stuff. And then so you moved into there to sales and marketing. So like I'm passionate about sales and marketing. Like I love the idea of like what do I need to do to influence someone to make a decision that's going to be beneficial and valuable to them, but also to help us grow our business and help more people. So I have that, you know, very holistic sort of if I'm going to market something, I want to make sure it's extremely valuable, like the end result, the return on investment for anyone. But then I think if you don't create the right level of marketing and sales process, then people don't buy from you. So you can't provide a service at all. So I'd love to hear from you to speak on that for builders. Like what are some of the things that you see people do wrong when it comes to sales and marketing from your experience now working with so many people in that space?
I think it's a lack of preparation and accountability. So in terms of preparation, it's getting very clear on who your ideal client is, where you sit in the marketplace? You know, what's your point of difference? All these fundamentals, really, that are just so, so important before you spend a single dollar amplifying your message. So you've really got to spend some time, you know, and this is where I think it really pays off to work with someone with experience, because you know, as a business owner, you can't just pluck this stuff out the air. You know, you need to work with someone that understands and can coax it out of you, maybe what those points are. But once you've got your marketing messages really clear, it's time to go to market and amplify that message. And referrals are great. You know, we love referrals. They are the cream on the top. In order to scale a business, you've got to be able to turn a paid lead into a customer. Yeah, that is absolutely critical. And I think what goes wrong a lot of the time here is, you know, as business owners, we want to ramp up. The business is doing well. We've got some money to invest to grow it even further. And we find a marketing agency and we delegate all that responsibility without holding them to account. And and we know what the marketing agency is going to do. They're going to, each month, they're going to tell us how many clicks they got to our website, which is absolutely meaningless. Yeah, means nothing. And even if you get a sophisticated one that tells you how many leads they generated, that is still meaningless as well. The only thing that really counts in terms of marketing is how many marketing qualified leads were generated. Yeah, how much they cost, you know, per marketing qualified lead, and how did that compare to your budget? And does that fit in with your business plan? Can you turn these marketing qualified leads into clients at a profit, or, you know, within the allocated budget for your marketing and advertising? And once you've got that figured out, you can hold your agency to account, make it very clear on the metrics you're working to. Don't listen to them when they say no, but, and we need to look at this. You know, it's all deflection. It's all to try and confuse you and keep you paying the money month on month. You know, be very clear, hold them to account.
I think that's, so many people have been burnt by marketing agencies, you know, and, you know, that pulling the wool over the eyes sort of thing and making it seem like they're getting better results than they are. And I definitely understand this whole concept as well. And what really matters is that you're getting, like you said, clients that are going to pay, and then that volume that you get off the back end of that client, and comparing that to what you've actually spent. So total return on investment, or return on ad spend, and then.
Yeah, and it can be quite difficult as well, because if we consider, if you're a plumbing company, and maybe you're focused on the consumer end of the market with emergency call-outs, well, you can measure your ROI really, really quickly and optimize your ad spend. But for a custom home builder, for instance, where it could take 12 months from initial inquiry to get that contract signed, how do you measure the ROI on that? And this is why it's so important to measure the cost per marketing qualified lead, rather than, you know, if you wait until, you know, and try and measure it on contract sign-ins, you know, you're going to be a year before you realize you're on the wrong path.
Would you do that on like a forecasted sort of framework, where it would be like, we've actually signed someone, they've put a deposit down, now we forecast that's what we're going to get. And we compare that to our ad spend. Is it worth us continuing to spend money on this, or how would you do that?
Well, there is a point where it doesn't really matter which channel they come from, whether it's Facebook, which does tend to be lower quality, or organic search, where it is a lot higher quality. It doesn't matter which channel they come from. Once they get to the stage of being sales qualified, they all convert very, very similar. So it's very important that you understand your metrics, and then you measure each channel against that cost per sales qualified, because it's still too long to wait until they go to contract. But if you are coming in at your budget on sales qualified lead, you know you're on the right path.
And you know you're going to get a certain percent conversion of those sales qualified.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to measure your KPIs, to understand what the KPIs are for the industry, and so that you can predict, like you say, you can predict what is going to happen in the future.
Yeah, interesting. Cool. Great stuff. Well, thanks for sharing. So you just touched on the scaling of a business. So I've worked with a lot of people where they start to scale without having the proper foundations in place. And I always talk around having too thin of a slab poured, and then you're trying to build a 50-story building on a thin, like a residential slab, and the walls just come in eventually and they'll collapse. And I think, you know, setting a really solid foundation, which I think that in your Association of Professional Builders, you're going to be working very closely with people, helping make sure they've got the proper foundations in place. Is that along the right path?
That is absolutely spot on. Pre-COVID, virtually an incredibly high percentage of builders that come to us. The reason they came to us was because they wanted to generate more leads, because if they had more leads, they'd make more sales, which means more revenue and more profit. But the first thing we did with every single member that joined was dig into their financials, because like you say, a lot of these companies were simply not profitable, or they were borderline profitable. And what that means, especially in a building company, but really in any small business, I think people underestimate the effect of owner's influence, the amount of work the owner does and how much it costs to replace you, because no one is going to work as hard and as fast as you do in your own business. So as you scale up, you have to delegate more. And what that means is when you actually look at your fixed expenses, and in particular your fixed expense ratio, which is fixed expenses divided by revenue, that percentage will climb as you move from being a small company with a big owner influence to a larger company with more staff. That percentage will increase. And that is what wipes out a lot of small businesses as they scale. It's how they go from being like borderline profitable to thinking, if I had more sales, I'd make more money. But it's actually quite the opposite.
Yeah.
They start losing money. And then in the case of residential home builders doing new construction, because they're cash flow positive, they don't even realize they're losing money. And that's why they end up in such big trouble.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like, because our time as business owners is limited. We can't keep scaling our own time. And with the amount of effort we put in, I don't think people take that in consideration when pricing and formulating what's profitable and what's not.
A great bit of advice I heard from a business coach whenever we came up with a new idea, what we wanted to do, it was like, okay, what are you going to take off the table? You can't take on any additional work unless you're removing something. And he always forced us to look at what we were doing and what were we going to stop doing in order to do this new thing. It was a great bit of advice.
Was it stop doing, or who are you going to hire, or both?
Well, that's another great way of looking at things. It's not, not always about the role. It's like, what are they going to do? Yeah, it's bringing these people on. And that's how you buy time, isn't it? You know, it's, we can't scale our time, but we can buy more of it by employing people.
Yeah, totally. So you touched on a really interesting point there around the, as you're scaling and you're putting on staff members, making sure that they've got the capacity to be able to do the work. But then we've got the pressure of the market saying, you know, you can't charge that because this is what the cheaper builders are doing it for. So you want to maintain a high level of quality, but also you've got people that are in the industry that actually don't know how to price and they're undercutting everyone. Mm-hmm. So what's your experience around that? And maybe a word of advice for people who are getting sucked into that because they think that's what they need to do to get work and stay in business.
That is probably the most common challenge that we have to overcome. It's all related to mindset. And if I charge more, I wouldn't get any work. And the truth is, you would. And the reason for that is because margins are linked to marketing. And that is because of the fundamental law in business that's always been there. And that is the law of supply and demand. And the more demand you have for your service, the more you can raise your prices. And the key for that in our industry with builders and it would work for subcontractors as well is a process we call construction slots. And that is a builder forecasting and budgeting how many builds he can do over the course of the year and then allocating start dates throughout the year. Mm. Those are his construction slots. Now what that does, that actually caps his supply. So now all he has to do is grow his demand and to the point that he has two clients wanting each construction slot. Now he has scarcity and urgency in his pipeline, and now he's the builder in demand. He's creating a backlog, and it creates that urgency to get them to contract, but it also helps him to increase his margins as well without worrying about the consequences.
Yeah, love that. That's so good. Yeah, creating that supply demand. Well, I think we see that naturally happen at the end of the, for subcontractors especially that do lots of small jobs at the end of the year before Christmas, because everyone's trying to get the work done before Christmas and the demand goes right through the roof. It's like a perfect supply and demand situation.
That Christmas judgment. Deadline, you got to love it, haven't you?
Yeah, cool. I love it. All right, cool. I'd love to speak from your experience. Like, what do you think makes a good subcontractor? Like, what are the attributes, you know, electricians, plumbers, carpenters, like whoever it is, what makes a great subcontractor to a builder? Like, what would be those things that a builder goes, you're the best, like out of everyone?
Yeah, look, I think there's two things that builders look for. First of all, it's someone that can integrate themselves to the extent they become part of the builder's team, part of the builder's resources. And the easiest way to do that is through the quote process. And I know there are a lot of builders that simply work on your rates as a subcontractor, put them into their estimate. But in order for a builder to go fixed price contract, they really need a fixed price quote, and you can help leverage up their time by providing that quote to them. So they are simply including that in, as part of their bill of quantities. So if you can integrate yourself and provide a valuable service, then that is one good way of having a builder increase his loyalty towards you. But the other part is the reliability. And not a lot of people realize, and I include builders in this as well, just how much it costs the building company for every 1 day delay. The figures are in the region of $750 a day off the net profit. So that's not off the revenue. It's not off the gross profit. It's right out the bottom line. Yeah. So if unforeseen circumstances come up and you've been delayed by builder A on a job, which is now impacting builder B, and you tell builder B, I can't get there, till Wednesday when you were supposed to be there Monday, that has potentially cost that builder $1,500. And, you need to be aware of that, because that is hurting the builder. And if the builder is aware of it, that's going to be a black mark against you. So reliability, turning up on time, absolutely crucial. And of course, as part of that, it's a two-way street. You want to work with builders that are organized and have the materials available for you to work on, so that equally your time isn't wasted. So as much as we encourage our builders to identify their cost per day and share that information with subcontractors so they're aware, it works the other way too. As a subcontractor, you have a cost per day for days lost. And, if a builder lets you down by not having the materials ready on site, that's a cost to your business.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have so many examples of where the subcontractor will rock up and things aren't ready. It's like, oh, I've booked out the whole day and now I can't even start because of XYZ. And so they have to go and reschedule something, pull jobs forward, and it impacts the efficiency of their day. So like you said, two-way street. So really, really, really cool. So with the like problems that builders have with subcontractors, it might be the inverse of what you said, but is there any other things that you think are red flags to builders when subcontractors do certain behaviors that people can look out for?
Yeah, I mean, there's the obvious ones, like the quality of work, not coming back to fix stuff, is always a major issue, and that's going to burn the relationship over the longer term. So yeah, if you are serious about growing your business profitably, then really I think the backbone of that is good, strong, ongoing relationships. So it's important to have this open communication and work together so that the builder can understand your viewpoint on things and things that are hurting your business and reasons as to why you might not want to work for them over the longer term, so that they can address those things and equally be open and even proactive to a large degree. Ask them, how can we serve you better? What is it you need in a subcontractor?
Yeah, no, great tips there. So when it comes to pricing and variations as well, so how can subcontractors communicate more effectively? Because I have been speaking with a builder just a couple of weeks ago where they were wearing the cost of variations because they didn't want to upset their subcontractors. And so I was like, what are you doing? Because this is like, is there a way you can communicate with the client or just make sure that nothing goes ahead until it's approved? But yeah, it was, you know, pretty much cutting all of their profit away. So in those situations, you know, what would be the best thing for a subcontractor to do to make sure that the builder, you know, is still reliable to the client, but also, you know, not blowing things out of the water every time?
Yeah, it's the very definition of madness, isn't it? Doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So, yeah, if a builder is losing all their net profit on variations, then, yeah, it begs the question, you know, why aren't you communicating this to both the client and the subcontractor? Yeah, you just got to have clear process in place, you know, no variations unless agreed in writing. So, yeah, I'd be a little concerned about the builder not communicating that because you think, what is their business plan here? And that's really all it is. It's, you know, it is clear communication. I guess it's not just variations, is it? It's also material price increases you know, that have been coming into play, and that does leave builders exposed. One thing we have recommended our builders to be doing over the past 2 years is reprice contracts before they start, because it's not ethical to attempt to pass on increases to a consumer halfway through a build when they're not expecting them. You know, just because that build was delayed 6 or 9 months from even starting, which, you know, really did compound these increases, when really that builder could have repriced the job before it started and given the consumer the option to cancel the contract if they weren't comfortable to go ahead. That really was the correct and ethical way to go about those things.
I think that's a fear. Oh, what if I lose the job? Like, so they don't say anything and it results in a poor result in terms of performance of the build.
Yeah. And really it should be, what if they don't lose the job and I lose money on the job? Yeah, that's got to be worse, hasn't it? I mean, you're better off sitting on a beach than doing a lot of these jobs that especially some of these larger building companies have been doing over this past year, because they signed so many contracts at the back end of 2020 that they couldn't do in 2021. They just got stacked up in linear fashion, which meant in 2022, they lost even more money on those contracts.
Oh, just compounding effect. So that's I think you were saying before the session, a new legislation or regulation coming out in terms of being able to do those price changes that you were talking about, materials?
What we were talking about was cost escalation clauses, which culturally are not included in Australia at all. And even in some states, like Victoria, for instance, they're illegal regardless of the contract on contracts below 500,000. Now, this is a crazy situation, especially when you compare Australia to other countries around the world where cost escalation clauses are included as standard. So the challenge builders have got, if they do include it as a special condition in their contract, the financial institutions are rejecting them. You got to ask, why would the financial institutions reject them when in countries like New Zealand and the US and Canada, they accept them? And the answer to that is, in Australia, the financial institutions mortgage people to the hilt. They actually take every last dollar they possibly can. And there's no room to move. So they cannot afford, a 10% cost escalation clause to come in, because it will just leave them too exposed. So, yeah, that's the truth behind it. There's more margin in, applied by lenders around the world compared to Australia, and it's resulted in builders being very exposed and being, as we've seen, being wiped out because of it.
It's crazy. Yeah. So do you think if a client was to get a lower LVR, so maybe like a 70% LVR or 60%, they would be more open to approving a contract with a builder who had that clause in place?
Yeah, absolutely. It does affect the, obviously the ones that are taking a higher percentage of loan to valuation. Yeah, absolutely. But I think the thing consumers have to be aware of now is that obviously after 2 years of construction increases of 20% year on year, builders have got wise to this. And if they can't insert a cost escalation clause, well, they have to price that risk into their contracts, which means adding on another like 20-25% to cover potential increases. So as a consumer, would you rather have that factored in where maybe costs aren't going to go up as much, or would you rather take the risk and have the clause in there instead?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And maybe if that's propositioned to them beforehand, they'll think about it. You can have it for this much with the clause or this much without the clause. So with that clause, how does that actually work? So say if we did put that clause into the contract, does that mean that halfway through the job, they could say, look, materials have gone up, we're going to have to increase the cost to match the material increase plus markup? Or how does that actually work?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, they obviously have to justify the cost. They can't just pluck them out the air. But yeah, with what we've seen over the past couple of years, it's been quite easy to justify those costs. But it's not been very common in Australia. Those clauses are on the increase. And as part of our survey of the industry last year, back end of last year, around about a third of builders in Australia are now including those clauses as special conditions. However, when you compare it to somewhere like the US, where two thirds of builders include them as standard, we're still way, way behind those guys.
Is that something that subcontractors should be considering as well? And would that include variations? So it's like, well, this subcontractor said this is illegal wiring here, they have to rewire that bit, for example, or this this drainage needs to be redone, we couldn't see until the house was lifted or something. So those situations could be the cost escalation, or would you go for a standard variation in that?
If it's a change or if the information wasn't known at contract, it's a variation. Because you're quoting on a provisional sum at that point. I think in terms of material increases, I think subcontractors should look at protecting themselves as well, because equally they don't want to be exposed and running a job, with no profit in it or even at a loss.
Yeah. No, that's really good points. Something I actually hadn't considered for my contracting business. So that's good to know. So with the marketing towards builders, so say if there's subcontractors and they want to get in, start a relationship with a builder, what's some of the things that you've heard from builders who they may have shared some stories around, this subcontractor reached out to me this way, or this is how I found my contractors. What's some tips around that, or some stories that you can share around subcontractors getting in with builders?
Yeah, the most common one that we've heard recently has come about as a result of the APB chapters that we've been setting up around Australia. And these are small meetings that are run by builders for builders. So they might be called APB chapters, but they're nothing to do with APB membership or even getting builders to join APB. It's purely there. We've set these up as a support networks. And that came about really because of the mental health issues within the construction industry and the need for support for builders by builders. So we've helped facilitate these meetings, and they've gone beyond purely mental health. They're more about builders catching up together now, talking about the challenges. Obviously a lot of discussions about clients and problem clients, but another thing that's come out is suppliers and subcontractors and positive discussions as well. So we have this idea, and really it's been in place for years, that builders do not talk to each other. They don't share information. They're very guarded. But what we find within our network of builders is they're very open and honest, and they're very willing to share and help each other. So we have these local chapters going on around Australia where builders invite their direct competition to come along and sit down and chat, and they exchange information. They talk about the suppliers they're dealing with that are giving a good service and subcontractors they'd recommend. So that's where I'm hearing most of the recommendations coming out of at the moment.
Yeah, it's so good. Yeah, we're a big fan of that as well, and it's so encouraging to see people actually reaching out for help, and not even for help, just to be a part of a community where you can speak openly without the fear of being attacked, like on like Facebook groups, or you know, if yeah. anyone asked a legitimate question on a Facebook group, I actually don't know. Everyone's like, "You fucking idiot! Don't you know that you should get out of business? Go die!" Like they say this stuff, like, "Whoa, crazy!" So it's so good to that you're facilitating those in groups, and we're a big fan of open communication and being able to be vulnerable and share your actual feelings and to be heard and be supported in that in the same sense.
It's a lonely place, isn't it, business? And I think what you just said was so important, be vulnerable. The best leaders globally are the ones that open themselves up and are vulnerable. You can look at any of them, and the guys that do this, they lead their teams extraordinarily well.
Yeah, I think they just allow themselves to learn rather exactly. than the ego saying, no, I can do this. I've got this. I don't need help. Like that's closed door. You're not growing.
Yeah, it's not what you know that you don't know that really bites you. It's what you don't know that you don't know. That's what really sneaks up and hurts you.
So true. So true. Cool, Russ. Well, hey, it's been an excellent conversation. I hope you've enjoyed chatting to us, and really excited for you to continue doing what you're doing. You know, it's such a great thing for the building industry. So keep up the great work.
Thanks, Greg. Love chatting with you. It's been awesome.
Thanks so much. See you later.
See ya.
All right, we'll pause it there.